So I know two or three more people are going to be drifting in, but I would suggest that we, if you're interested, form a ring the way we did last night for the forum, so we have, because this is going to be more of a conversation tonight. So
storytelling.
Storytelling. So.
And you just got everything arranged beautifully.
Kids.
He just forgot what he was doing.
Come take the front row. He's encouraging us to move up.
We're all going to be in one cozy circle here.
Okay.
Right. So, but you're in charge of bringing your own chairs up or finding a chair that's empty or and cushions and water and coffee.
Oh.
Tonight, our theme is polyphonic voices because we will be all having a chance to blend our voices together into a beautiful polyphony and talk about moments or occasions when music has touched us in some way, perhaps profoundly, perhaps sadly, perhaps humorously, but significantly, and to reflect on why music did this to us when perhaps just the spoken word would have not have had the same effect. And Chris will probably have his want to supplement that before. But before, I wanted to add one more thing to my two sessions right now. Is that okay, Chris?
Yeah.
And that is
just say what we've been doing all week as a way to add to.
Okay, we have been talking about two strands really of musical culture, sometimes with relation to the church, but sometimes just musical culture in general, and looking at what part it plays in our lives, in the lives of our culture, how it has affected culture, and in one case, we looked at the relationship between even just naked musical sound and what it is, the nature of sound, and how, what the relationship to that, and what the relationship between nature and sound and culture and meaning is. So we've looked at it from a number of perspectives, and Chris has been very good at letting you talk. I've not been very good at letting you talk, so tonight, I will talk less, and we will share some stories. The thing I wanted to add to my observation, I wanted to add to things that I said, is that looking back on history is sometimes a strange and wonderful thing. And I talked Wednesday about the overtone series and scale and chords and tuning of scales. That seems like very abstruse subject matter, but it was one that J.S. Bach was profoundly interested in. What is the content of our music? What effect does it have on us? And he, one person was observing, he wrote two series of 24 preludes and fugues. One prelude and fugue in each major and minor key, and he did the whole cycle twice. And not only was this the first time that something like this had been done successfully, but he did it in such a way as to show off the nature, the intrinsic nature of every key, because every key spoke something to him emotionally. What he was missing was an iPhone. Because in the iPhone, as soon as I've logged in,
I'd almost forgotten what that looked like.
Yes. I can go to my little music box. Where's my music? There's my music box. And in my music box, I have a little tuner. but this is not an ordinary tuner.
Even
as I'm talking, it's clicking around and it's telling what pitch I'm talking at, and it's also telling me how many cycles per second my voice is moving. But that's not all, folks, because I can go in and I can tell it what vibration is A. A is not necessarily 440 beats per second. I'm in charge of how many beats. But not only that, folks, I can go to those temperaments that Bach was so interested in. And a temperament is a way a keyboard is tuned to make it work out to 12 pitches. And there was a problem in the 18th century because it was easy to play in D major, C major, D minor, and so forth. But as soon as you got into C sharp major, you were in deep doo-doo because your keyboard was so rankly out of tune. So he came up, Franz came up with a system of tuning the harpsichord to make possible his 12 preludes in major and minor keys. And I can go on here, the temperament, and scan down through Pythagorean tuning, which you heard about, and go to a whole section of well-tempered systems, almost equal, Aaron Neihardt, Barnes Bach, Kellner's Bach, Kirchenberger III. I have almost a dozen well-tempered systems in this little thing, and I can punch on that and tune my harpsichord. Bach had to do that all by hand, the poor guy. So that's enough of that. That was just...
I was kind of hoping we'd hear you play our harpsichord this week, but it hasn't happened. The occasion hasn't arisen.
No. So, next time.
We have a harpsichord over at the Village Center.
And we've worked with that before. We've done stuff for baroque flute and harpsichord, and it's a rare Lutheran camp that has a tuba and a harpsichord and a copper mic piccolo. Yeah. What would you add to as a prologue, Chris?
We came to this out of an enthusiasm and love of music, and we shared, I think, both of us, some music that we love. Not that I don't love Bach, and not that Paul doesn't now at least love hip hop. But we all along had the conviction that the reason music is worth talking about is because music moves us, and we live our lives through song and music. And my teacher, Don Saliers, talks about moments, in a sense, evoking song. You can be in a certain place or smell a certain smell, and it can take you to a certain memory that's associated with the song. And so we wanted to introduce opportunity for all of us to reflect on and share about those moments when songs have sort of lived our lives, or we've lived our lives through song, and hear the diversity of ways that that happens and marvel in that. And we wanted to do that for a chunk of time, but then at the end of our time to stop and say, so what range of that kind of singing our lives is possible in church? And what does our hymnal allow us in terms of a range of singing our lives, all different kinds of songs, all different kinds of circumstances? And Paul and I thought we would start just by each telling a story out of our own life and our own deep love and affinity with music in some particular way, and then give you maybe 5 minutes of quiet just to, if you want to jot notes down or just reflect for yourself, so what are the moments that really come to mind, and then open it to sharing stories. And I think if we share stories, then the concreteness of the stories will surprisingly be something that all of us will be able to connect to. Stories have that remarkable ability to both be extremely unique and somehow something many other people can relate to. So Do you want to start or should I start?
If one of you moves next to the other, there's more than one person. I beg.
Tell you what, I'm more antique than you, so I'll start first.
Okay. We're going to have a second row anyway, so yeah. We love you in the second row.
That's right. And by the way, thank you all so much for coming and sharing these sessions with us, because it's, as Chris said, this is something we've been dreaming about for a while. Thank you to those who've just arrived on campus, if this is your first session, because I think it will make, hopefully, be helpful even separated from the other sessions. It is not dependent upon having been to all the other sessions. Probably telling an anecdote or a musical story of peace just kind of scratches the surface, because we probably all have many times when music has powerfully intersected with our lives. And so I've been disciplining myself. I'm going to tell about six stories, but then that would be selfish. So I can tell one story. This is, a lot of times music touches us strongly in times of, in end times, in critical times in our lives or lives of friends. And this was one of those times. I was raised in the Great American Band tradition as a flutist, and went off and played in the St. Olaf Band under this amazing leader, Miles Johnson, Mighty Johnson, he's called in an endearing way. Mighty Johnson had an incredible memory, not only for music, he conducted everything without score, finally, and remembered just about every little nuance in a piece, and everything was in his ears, so he could tell when something was to his liking and when it was not. But he also knew everyone that had ever played in his band. He never forgot a game. So it was ironic that towards the end of his life he developed Alzheimer's and lost his ability to speak, to say nothing of recognizing his students. So a few years ago, there was a reunion of past St. Olaf band members and a concert and banquet in his honor, which he could not attend because he was in a rest home. And his wife was there in his representing him, because she was dear to us too. And it was a wonderful concert, and we had a wonderful banquet, and recounted the rich stories for the tradition of this band. And then the next day, upon the encouragement of his wife, I went down and visited him at the rest home. And he was asleep, so I was about to go, but the nurse said, "No, why don't you stay? We should wake him up. He'd want to talk." So she woke him up, and I went in, and Mighty usually did the talking. Now, in this case, the table turned, I did the talking, and I started telling stories, remember when, and what do you think, and you remember him, and you remember her, and Mighty would nod and grunt, and then a couple other band alumni came in, and more stories went around the room. It was a touching occasion, but I sensed that Mighty was getting tired, and he said, "Well, maybe it's time. We're wearing you out. We should go." No, he didn't want us to go. He was loving the stories. But we ran out of stories, and sat there for a moment. I said, "You know, Mighty, we had a wonderful concert in your honor last night. We wish you could have been there. But among other things, we played one of your favorite works. We played movements from Elgar's Enigma variations, and your very favorite one, the Nimrod variation." I started to sing it and got all choked up, you know. And I didn't know if I could continue when Mighty himself started singing because it was deep in his conscience. Couldn't talk, but he could sing. Uh-huh. And we made it through to the end of his song. And then he died a month later, and that's the mighty I had in my mind. Mm-hmm. Still can't quite get through that one.
It's all right. It's all
right. That's worth just holding with a moment of silence. I'm sure many of us have had stories of depth and emotion related to music, and so let's just honor it with a moment of silence before I move on and tell a story. I wanted to say something about my love of rock and roll and its ability to channel political protest. And it's rooted really in African American music being a vehicle of protest against oppression, I think. Rock and roll, the blue Muddy Waters wrote a song that says, the blues had a baby and it's called rock and roll. And I think it's true, and that ethos of being against the establishment, being a space of criticism, has always been true about rock and roll. I was just looking at the cover of the New York Times, a recent New York Times, and there's this article about Russian punk women's punk band that did a song protest against Vladimir Putin in the Orthodox Cathedral, and they were arrested, and they were just sentenced to 2 years in prison for this, basically a political, theatrical production of the song, praying to the Virgin Mary to rid them of Putin. And so it's an example to me of just a very fresh contemporary example of rock music being a vehicle of political protest. But the story that I think is really meaningful and deep for me was I sort of came of age politically during Reagan's era as president and the illegal wars we were fighting in Central America and elsewhere. And I had grown up having rock and roll and church separated. I remember distinctly going to this youth group gathering where we were severely scolded for ever considering listening to rock and roll music, and didn't you know this was satanic? And if you played the record backwards, you would hear, you know, encouragements to worship Satan and all this. And so I didn't know these worlds could come together, pop music and church going, until I was in college and I met the band U2, who are Irish and Christian, but never a band that played Christian music in the sort of genre sense. They play rock and roll, and they happen to be Christian. And they wrote and then released an album called The Joshua Tree that came out in the late 80s, and it came partly out of their experience traveling in El Salvador and experiencing what was happening and trying to think about this country that was such a supportive place for them to play, and yet this country was doing these things they really disagreed with. And so it's a very political album, The Joshua Tree was. And Sonia and I, my wife and I, weren't married. We were at PLU, and we both were very politically active. Sonia had gone to Nicaragua as a part of a semester abroad and had picked coffee on a Sandinista farm, and so we were a part of the student protests about the Iran-Contra connection, and we really liked this new album, and we liked having a rock and roll album that gave us a sort of political voice, a way to sing our frustration. And in fact, one of the songs, how many people know U2? Just so everyone knows U2. So that album has a song, Bullet the Blue Sky, which uses an electric guitar to sound like bombs falling. And it's about El Salvador and the Civil War that went on there. Anyway, so Sonia and I have fall birthdays, and it just turned out that you two were playing Vancouver on November 12th, which is Sonia's birthday. And so I bought tickets to the concert so that we could go hear you two play. And I told her, and I expected her to be really excited. And she had got this sort of really, like, unhappy look on her face, and I was like, uh-oh. And she said, how much did you pay for those? And I said, well, they were $40 each. And she said, this was in our totally righteous phase, so she said, do you really think that's justified when people are starving and struggling in Civil War? I mean, the whole album is about helping people who are in that kind of plight. And I was like, yeah, that's probably right. I didn't think about that. And so we talked, and we had this long conversation, as you do when you're in college and in law. Late into the night, we decided it wasn't right that we would spend $80 to go hear you two in concert, and so we sold the tickets to our friends who went and had a great time. And so many years later, when I was teaching confirmation and using you two as a vehicle for getting the kids thinking about religious questions, I used pop music to get them thinking about religious questions, and started to write a book about you two and the Christian faith. Out of that, my editor said, you know, it would be awkward, Chris, for you to publish a book about you two never having actually seen them in concert. So I finally saw them when I was like 40 years old. But they've continued to be, for me, a band that's just a fantastic connection between politics and Christian faith to this day, every album.
Were you here about 3 years ago, and did you do a presentation about you two?
I have been known to do that.
Three or 4 years ago is great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you start talking about it, I go, oh, that's the guy.
Yeah. Well, that's a launching, I guess. Let's just see, are people ready to tell stories? We maybe don't need a moment of silence.
I want to speak to Paul.
Oh, okay.
I worked in an Alzheimer's unit, and their patients were distressed, upset, or whatever. One of the mechanisms we could focus them back to something was music. Mm-hmm. Always music. Calm them down, comfort them. And, you know, we tried to find out what kind of music they liked as a group, as a person. Mm-hmm. You know, if you played U2 for me, I would not be happy.
Yeah.
You pay Beethoven for me, and I'm thrilled. So, you know, you have to know what their feelings mm-hmm. are, but yeah. it really works. Music is across the world.
Yeah. And whatever your genre is, whether it's Beethoven or U2, as you dig into it, as you become part of it, mm-hmm. it becomes part of you. It becomes inseparable, and it becomes a little deeper than our linguistic skills, as you say.
It's not just listening, it's living into the music that you're listening to, whatever
yeah.
it is.
Yeah.
Well, as we told stories, what stories came to your mind?
Yeah.
Let's hear some.
I have a story that is at the other end of the spectrum. I'm part of the gospel choir that's going to be singing tomorrow.
Yeah.
And we're here in part because we've been together for 10 years, which makes my now 13 and 15-year-old kids, they were exposed to this music in a really deep way when they were 3 and 5. And it was just so wonderful to because they just soaked it all in. And we sang a lot of songs by an artist called Kirk Franklin,
mm-hmm.
Kirk Franklin and the New Nation Project. And so I'm buying CDs right and left, and we're listening to them at home, and we're listening to them in the car. And pretty soon, my 3-year-old and 5-year-old are walking around the house singing, "For All My Sins Are Washed Away,"
mm-hmm.
and other little gospel earworms that just roll around and around and around in your head. And I could not have expected the gift to our family, that gospel music.
Lovely. It's Martin Luther, of course, used music in a very similar way as a way of teaching and communicating the spiritual depth of his faith to his confirmands and his congregation. So, not just within Lutheranism, but certainly within Lutheranism, has a long and important tradition as a way of passing it on.
In Christian education.
Yeah.
The kids would say from time to time, "Mom, is that your choir?" No.
Others. Thank you.
Other people. Yeah.
When my mom was dying from Alzheimer's, we sang a lot in the end, and we sang Healer of Our Every Ill and different hymns. And it's hard in a way, because when you're a singer and you share that with in a lot of different of those really juicy moments in your life, it makes them really sensitive. And so being at church is difficult sometimes because when you're singing that song, you can't help but just link. You said You link exactly back, and you're right there again.
It's like a hot link.
Which is good and difficult, both. Yeah. But it's a blessing. And so many hymns my mom and I had, and we had favorites together, you know, that through the different eras of our life together, we had hymns that would, they'd be new, you know. What was the hymn in the, it's the one about in the classroom, Earth and All Stars.
Yeah.
And that she was a teacher, and you know, when I was a kid, that was fun to sing with her, and you know, so it's a connection, it's a connecting thing, music.
Do you know there's a connection between Herbert Brokering, the author of that text, and David Scherer,
our rapper.
Dearly departed rapper.
Not dearly
I mean, at least for him. He's still very much with us. It's hard to go home. But at any rate, Brokering was one of his mentors. And Brokering felt that David had one of the next voices for the church in his poetry. I think David will be one of our next fine poets that whose poetry really stays with us. Thank you.
Yeah.
I was raised in a family that was basically Baptist until I was born. But then my mother went to the Baptist church, and I did too. And any song you sang from the Baptist church had the blood in it. It's just the way Baptist music is. And so I would sing along to those songs, and as I got to be an adult, then I would buy the Mary Anthem, I would buy the Chris Franklin, Kurt Franklin, and sing along, and I decided I wanted to sing music. And so I joined my church choir. And the first night I was there, this woman looked down on me, and she said, "My God, you don't even read music." And I was so devastated by that, I just never went back again. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I don't read music. So I'm not worthy of singing music. And then I was introduced to wonderful gospel musicians. And one of them was Kent Stevenson. He said, "I can help you sing." Mm-hmm. And I sang in the Pan-African Mass Choir. And one of the exciting times I ever sang was to sing Duke Ellington's Lord's Prayer at St. Joe's. And I thought to myself, I've been given this, you know, not gift, but I've been given this opportunity to be able to do what's in my heart. And just because I couldn't read music, I wasn't worthy. And so now that I'm singing in a gospel choir that doesn't require that, it's filled my soul.
Beautiful. One of the sort of tensions, if you want to put it that way, between what Paul's been presenting this week and what I've been doing, is I've been working out of traditions where they're not musically schooled. They don't necessarily read music or know music theory or anything, and that part of the reason the blues and even hip-hop are talked about in gospel as soulful, I think, is because that's the primary sort of tutor of the songs. And sometimes I lament how arrogant Lutherans are about musical prowess and four-part mm-hmm. harmony and being able to read music and have books, because so much of Christianity isn't that. So it's a little bit of a brave thing for you to tell that story in your own vulnerability, but it's a really important story. And I think there are lots of people who would love to let their soul sing, but they don't quite have the context that makes them feel okay about it. So thanks very much for sharing that. And I'm so delighted you have a place to sing.
Yes, I am too.
That's awesome.
And it's also a question of how do these traditions talk to each other?
Yeah.
Because after all, reading music is a tool, like reading a book is a tool that fits a particular genre. Reading music has not been a tool in the blues tradition or in many other traditions, and certainly not in many of the traditions that came into our LBW, our ELW, as a written tradition. They came out of unwritten traditions.
Yeah.
So, but still the question is, when you have a schooled, formal tradition of practicing music and an oral tradition, which is schooled in a different sense,
mm-hmm. really.
Absolutely. They're both schooled,
yeah.
but different tools. How do these traditions court each other and enrich each other?
Yeah, that's part of the territory we hoped we would get to working through this week.
And we may, I think we've just started the process.
Yeah. Well, I think if they could rap while you play harpsichord tonight, over in the, we will be there.
So yeah.
What time were you free?
I have to look and see if I have the right temperament in my iPhone.
Technology.
Yeah. I'll tell you a pair of family stories. There's so many stories about music. It's just like impossible. All the political stories and the kids' mm-hmm. stories, and I mean, it's like, where do you choose? Music is so central. But we've always sung as a family. That's just what we do, and we sing lots of different kinds of things. And the two ones that struck me, once we were on a Boundary Waters trip, canoeing in northern Minnesota, and the four of us were there, and we have two sons, and we were singing in four-part harmony, which is what we do, and a ranger came up and told us we were disturbing the environment, so that we had to be quiet. So, I don't know, but so what we did was get as far away from civilization as we could, as fast as we could, and found a campsite where nobody was around, so we could sit and sing. And all the loons came and sang. So apparently the loons didn't mind, even though they did. But then we also had our first flash mob experience as a family. We were sending our son off to Tanzania for a year, our older son, and we had sung in church, which is the only way we could ever get our kids to church, because they wouldn't come for any other reason besides music. And we were sending Nathaniel off, and Benjamin, who was the kid who was totally non-church, but we had sung a Russian quartet in the morning, and or the day before or something. And this was back before everybody had to go through security,
You could go to the gate.
And as we were sending Nathaniel off for a year, Benjamin said, "Can we just sing?" And the four of us sang this Russian anthem in the middle of the airport. And everybody got quiet. It was just so amazing. Yeah. And our younger son, who, as I said, is not, one of these God kids. I mean, he was crying. We were crying and singing together. And I just think of that as kind of what we do.
Family flash mob,
please. Thank you.
As a pastor, I have participated in many concerts around the deathbed, and I'm sure many other people have too. And we've talked about how the dying are calmed and soothed and helped along on their journey out leaving this life by song. And that, I think that I happen to be an Episcopalian, that doesn't matter what denomination you are, that there are many denominations who I'm sure do this. And I've always thought that it's just a wonderful thing, and I've hoped that when the time comes, when it's time for me to die, that there will be people who can sing around my bedside, or, you know, if that happens to be the way I end up dying. But it just occurred to me, just tonight, that what there's this huge gap that we miss, and that is, where are the choirs when babies are being born? What an interesting thought. As a pastor and a woman pastor, I've been fortunate to be blessed to be at a number of births so that I could bless the baby immediately, give communion to the parents and the nurses and the doctor and so on. And that's been a really wonderful experience. But I thought, what was I thinking of? Why weren't we singing and welcoming a new life into this world? So if any of you have that opportunity, I hope you'll remember that, and I hope I will remember that. That's something that we could be doing for the newborns, is to introduce them to music from the very start.
See, the musical tradition, the whole tradition of worship is an open tradition, and there's always something that we need to enrich the tradition. As soon as it's fully enriched and done, it's cooked. But it's not. It's a live tradition. Thank the Lord.
Sonia, any singing at birth stories that you can recall? My wife, Sonia's sitting up on the balcony, and she's probably been at 1,500 births.
I have to say, never a choir. I can't quite envision the choir at the birth, but certainly people singing and certainly music being played. I've had some Muslim families, fathers just do amazing blessings of babies.
Sung blessings?
Sometimes sung. Really beautiful traditions around that. But then also I've sung to women in labor. I had one this year, a wonderful woman whose husband got stuck in an immigration issue, so she was alone. She's from Mali, and she was just one of the most lovely, lovely, gorgeous women. And I was with her, and we had a real connection. We couldn't really speak very well. I didn't speak her language, and she was from a rural area, and nobody could translate. And so I just was with her and holding her. And when the contractions got strong, and she would say, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. And so I just started singing in between contractions to her when she would finish, Jesus, remember me, just sort of as I was holding her. And I just kept singing into her ear in between. And then when the contraction would come, she would kind of take over the song, singing, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. And then it would end, and I would go back to singing, Jesus, remember me. And it was really, we had a wonderful, wonderful connection. Yeah.
When I learned Lamaze, we were in England, and we were taught to choose a song for labor. And I chose 'Tis a Gift to Be Simple, which I sang all through labor and slugged Paul at the same time.
How about others? Other stories that have been coming up in your minds, people who haven't had a chance to share yet.
I got two things to say. One, I think it's in our genes. The music was back. You know, we like campfires. Why do we like campfires? Because it's in our genes. And I think the music is the same thing. It's in our genes. And we all love and appreciate different kinds of music. And then on a much, much lighter note, and a completely different, in my previous job, I've been retired 10 years, there were times when you'd have a pretty tough day, and you'd be pretty ugly driving home. And my fix was to put that polka CD back in the... And about, you know,
polka CD.
About a mile later, the world was a much better place.
Mood-altering melody.
That's good.
Let's bring polka back.
The bumper sticker on my car is happiness is dancing a polka.
Over here.
Free exercise. Yes.
My daughter is on the autism spectrum, and she's 28. And I don't know how much folks know about autism, but a lot more than they did when I had her, which was 1984. Also Ronald Reagan time. The sensory world is extremely chaotic for folks on the spectrum. There's incoming, and all kinds of stuff is coming in. The smells, the sounds, the visuals are changing and shifting. And for her, her MP3 player, which she stocks, and which she backs up on a flash drive, and which she backs up on her old laptop computer, is like a sensory modulation machine. Because I've been much more patient about listening to her respectfully recently, I've discovered, lo and behold, that she has a whole lot more to say than I thought, because I was so busy raising her. And she's got reasons for every single song. She's explaining to me how each song will modify a particular moment or modify a mood. When she gets on the bus, because sometimes bus life is chaotic and unpredictable, MP3 player with those songs with particulars, and there's thousands of them on this MP3 player, gives her control. It gives her the ability to determine a portion of her sensory world. So for her, it's like life support. It's like a scuba, it's like a compressed air system for a scuba diver. It's that degree of important.
Yeah. My goodness. You don't often get a chance to think about music as necessary for life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in many, many, many ways.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to imagine living without.
Before MP3 players, it was a matter of taking and carrying hundreds of CDs. She had to have all of them with her all the time, which meant that they could be stolen.
Yeah.
And the degree of dismantling of her whole world when those CDs were gone. Yeah. And we've replaced CDs many times. Yeah. So now we back everything up. If we buy a CD, we make a copy of it and then we put it on the, you know. So we've got plan B and C and D, because it's really distressing. Life support.
Now, modern technology, just very quickly, is such a as it applies to music, is such a blessing and such an issue. We have a friend who loves recorded music of the best quality, but I don't know that I've ever known of him to go to a concert, because he has this notion of perfection that you can find in the CD, but you can't find it in the same way on the stage. I think he's missing a hole. But there's this, because of studio recordings, there's this notion of the type of perfection, at least in the classical world, that people expect on stage and is never attainable. On stage, it's only attainable with multiple takes and a lot of computer editing.
It's like an airbrush photo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's true. Whether you're doing classical music or a pop song, and the production level and commercial music is unattainable by most people until possibly the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Some of that is a struggle for me as the general idea of earbuds. And music is my own thing happening just inside of my head, and it is the, you know, the enormous perfect kind of artists, I think, has a really different sort of connection someplace inside of whatever our soul is than the let's sit around the living room or let's go to our dying grandmother or let's let what's inside of us and needs to be expressed come out. And I don't know if that is something that I feel in an overstated kind of way or if that's something that our culture will need to figure a way back around. And I was wondering that with Dave these days as well, that if this is a great expression of soul, of what's inside of a generation of people or a huge spectrum of people, where do we get the opportunity for them to release that, to participate in it, to do it, and not just to have it tucked in their ears in an individual receiving sort of way?
What, answer your question. That's a really interesting question. Mm-hmm. What, how, I mean, do you have earbuds?
No.
No. So how do you negotiate that and how do you think it works out? Because it's clearly really, really, really common.
And here to stay, I'm sure.
I mean, even
in
the name
some sense, yeah.
iPod
mm-hmm. yeah.
has that
mm-hmm.
implication. So what do you think happens with that?
Well,
I'm putting you on the spot on purpose because I want to hear a little more
yeah.
how you would think about that.
I think for Lutherans, maybe Lutherans of a certain age and spectrum, we do have a chance still to come together and join in that making of the music. I have, you know, we all have these stories of the great connections and the great moments. My dad was a choir teacher, and so that was a public school, and he used sacred music partly because he said that's what the vast amount of the tradition is, and so you can't just cut that out and still say that you're getting a choral education. But then, you know, that's the holding hands with my peers that still gives me goosebumps. And so in some ways we're good at that, we're ready to go with that. And
so it's probably the
maybe we're just a generation still back right now, that we're good at guitars and rock bands in worship. We see that, but that would be the next generation again, you know, that our high school kids at our congregation aren't going to come to the rock service because that's not the music. And, you know.
I see that as not dissimilar from the cable television challenges that have fragmented the experience of
yeah.
life.
Yeah.
This question can actually be approached both from the artist standpoint of how is my music being consumed, and oftentimes it'll be consumed individually in a unpredictable environment, not in the home stereo in the living room with family or some other such situation on the radio. But it's also the isolation of, I have no idea what you're doing, or what you're hearing, or what you're hearing. So every one of us ends up being an isolated entity, much more dramatically than the cable television issues that people were concerned about 10 or 20 years ago. And that the internet brings along in the last 10 years.
This is a really good segue, actually, to the hymnal. And we were just on the Ark before dinner, and my son Isaiah, who's 14 and likes to debate, apparently, said to Paul, who was sitting there with the ELW talking about how wonderful its diversity was, that it was heavy because it had to have so much stuff in it. Why not just make little hymnals that suit different people's tastes, and then they could just have a light one to hold that had music they liked in it. So, in a way, that debate was coming out in the pre-dinner conversation, and I'll let Paul take over with his...
It was a wonderful conversation.
He gave a response
yeah.
to Isaiah, which Isaiah was like,
Yeah.
I'm going to grab a copy of it.
And Isaiah made me go, as well. And with some of these issues, like music that segments us into different, very different groups, age groups, culture groups, music that individualizes us as an iPod or an iPhone can do. These things are both blessing and curse. We've heard how they're blessing. I'm just thinking, for example, another example beyond use of an iPod for someone who is on the autism spectrum, but the use of 78 RPM records in the history of the blues and how they became a teaching device. So people learn their licks from other great players whom they wouldn't have been able to afford to go and study with, but they could emulate that record and then beyond that record develop their own style.
Yeah.
So these technologies have become a powerful tool, but then a source of separation as well. And I think the notion of the richness of music backing up, if you're in a 16th century German Lutheran church, Evangelische Church, and you're singing hymns, that were written in the last 25, 50 years, some of them based on much older hymns, but you're singing the hymns that were popular or known then. If you're in 16th century Switzerland, you're singing the Genevan Psalter. If you're in an African-American community in Georgia, you're maybe singing just gospel music. If you're in a Swedish congregation, you get my point. There have been so many situations in time and culture where congregations or groups of people sang one type of music. And now we have an ELW that just cuts through the history of music and has brought world music, pop music, theater music, Germans, Scandinavian, African, South American, Latino, modern music together. How does it become a problem? How does it become a unifying force? How do we use it? And why the hell isn't hip-hop in the hymnal?
ELW?
I'm sorry, and that's a coded Lies. Talk among Lutherans for evangelical Lutheran worship. It's the latest hymnal.
Okay,
yeah,
thank
okay.
you.
Thank you. Should never talk in acronyms or
abbreviations. It has 893 hymns, and I think it's broadly viewed as one of the most diverse ecumenical hymnals that's been produced in the United States. And it was intentionally done to be a recent, that the Lutheran Church was producing segmented hymnals, and they intentionally decided to try and create a hymnal that gave everybody a broad palette of hymnody to work with. Including, I just opened it to Kirk Franklin. There's a Kirk Franklin song.
Interesting.
In the Lent section.
Which is it?
Now behold the Lamb.
Oh,
you know that
that's
one? The precious Lamb of God, who bore all my sin that I may live again. The precious Lamb of God.
So, I spend time in the back with, you know, going from the first line index to the tune index but it never even occurred to me to look for Kirk Franklin.
There's a lot of treasure in there.
There is.
Yes.
But what about, this is kind of a leap and we don't have to go there, but what about the contemporary worship? You touched on it earlier, something about the visual and the words. What about the big screen and the simple, dare I say, nondescript musicality of, you know, contemporary worship on the big screen with the seven or eight different tunes?
They're in here too.
Are they in there?
Some of those, yeah.
I did not know.
Some of them, it's affected it. Certainly, praise music has had more effect on the ELW than the hip hop culture. I came here with fear and trembling because I had nothing in common with hip-hop music, and I wondered what place will I have vis-a-vis David Sharon. And this whole week has been a revelation to me that there's a whole treasure that I was missing. And I think there's music coming out of the praise tradition, which I'm not particularly fond of, which has an enduring beauty to it. Mm-hmm. So it's how do we encounter what we dislike and find in that things that become meaningful to us sometime. But you're right. I mean, it's a segmented part that is. It kind of denies the hymnal when it goes up there. It's an issue.
I was thinking it makes it kind of obsolete.
Does it?
Well,
unless you're at the traditional service.
This is. I want to acknowledge, since I teach worship at a seminary, this opens a huge can of worms, mm-hmm. which we can't resolve in two more minutes of our time together. But I think it's really helpful when I'm talking with students about this to say, there are many sides to each of these contentious issues, and you can take the screen issue and say three or four really important things about it some people like, some don't. One of the things that happens with hymnal worship is people are singing like this. And when you have it up on the screen, all of a sudden people are singing like this. So I think there's maybe more diverse worship styles unfolding right now than at any point I can think of through the history of the church. Just unbelievable how much we can't really train pastors to go out and lead worship. We have to train pastors to be, number one, practical theologians, and number two, listeners, so they can go out and listen and make wise judgments about this particular place and the complexity of what they're doing. So maybe sometime in the past they taught pastors worship like landing a 747, but that would be a disaster now for exactly those kinds of reasons, all the changes. And this book, in a way, is an acknowledgement of that. It's speaking to a very diverse church and hoping for a church that will yet become more diverse, even if the actual makeup of a particular congregation doesn't change in racial ethnic diversity, it will change in its repertory diversity. And that in and of itself is planting seeds for the possibility of welcoming people who may be more diverse than the congregation is at the moment. Having a gospel choir at a congregation that's predominantly white.
I think this is a whole series of five things. but before we run out of time completely, I would like to make sure if someone has another story in the room that they'd like to share, that we're not overlooking it. I'm sure you all do. Yep.
Just a comment. Because we make of music something that's performance in many cases, and we, especially in the tradition I cherish, which is composed concert music, there's a way in which we say that's a special person who can do that, you know, play that violin, that symphonic literature, whatever. Church is, for some people, for many of us, the only place where we make live music, where we participate. And both politically, the songs of my protest formation in the 60s, and in terms of the feminist movement that came out of certain parts of the war, anti-war efforts of the 60s, the sense that we are a larger us, that the self... You can't hear yourself sing. You know you're singing, you know you're making a sound, but when it melts into a larger body, you feel like a part of an ocean, or you feel like a part of something that you can't quite explain, because you can't separate out what piece you're doing and what piece so-and-so is doing. You can't even really hear the person right next to you. So there's really something quite magical about the loss of self that temporarily occurs when we sing together. Mm-hmm. When we sing together without worrying about the alto part or the tenor part, when we just sing together, it's the unself-consciousness of hymns in church that I think is tremendous relief from our own consciousness, our own self-consciousness.
Beautiful. What a great comment to end on.
Maybe that is a wonderful place to end it. And I think we are very fortunate to have an expanding church in terms of traditions coming into our church. And always need to be searching to find how the traditions within our worship can enrich us and can bring us together as a community. So
thanks for
joining
us. Thank
you for all your stories. It's been wonderful.
Now we'll go make some music tonight.
Go make music. Yeah. Make a joyful noise.